Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The Biden agenda. The new president continues a flurry of executive orders with actions aimed at counteracting the economic damage wrought by COVID-19. Then, minding his business. Former President Trump leaves office facing mounting debt, devalued assets, and a scarcity of willing lenders.
He really runs the risk of being cash-strapped at a time when his banks and other businesses are turning their backs on him because of the January 6th insurrection.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down a historic inauguration, the Biden administration's early actions, and a looming impeachment trial. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Tackling the pandemic's devastating impact on the economy was top of mind for President Biden today. He assured Americans who are struggling to make ends meet that help is on the way. Our White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
The president's second full day in office and a focus on the pandemic's economic toll.
We're in a national emergency. We need to act like we're in a national emergency. So we've got to move with everything we've got. We've got to do it together. I don't believe Democrats or Republicans are going hungry and losing jobs. I believe Americans are going hungry and losing their jobs.
Last week, 900,000 Americans filed for unemployment benefits. Today, President Biden signed two executive orders aimed at delivering some economic relief. They include boosting food assistance benefits, improving the equal distribution of previously allocated direct payments, protecting unemployed job seekers, and raising the minimum wage for federal employees to $15 an hour. The move comes as Biden pushes Congress to pass a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. That plan would include an additional round of $1,400 stimulus checks. At a White House briefing, National Economic Council Director Brian Deese said the orders were not a substitute for congressional legislation.
The single most important thing economically right now is to take decisive action. The risk of undershooting far outweighs the risk of doing too much.
At the briefing, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki also said the Biden administration would be taking several steps to fight domestic extremism. They include requesting federal agencies conduct a threat assessment, building on the National Security Council's capability to counter extremism, and coordinating parts of the government to combat radicalization. That comes after the January 6th Capitol riot. President Trump is facing a second impeachment trial. He is accused of inciting that attack. The trial, though, is complicating the push for more COVID relief. Today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the House would deliver the impeachment article to the Senate on Monday. Still, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer stressed that lawmakers must balance the Biden agenda with impeachment.
We have three essential items on our plate. One, the confirmation of President Biden's cabinet and other key officials. Two, legislation to provide desperately needed COVID relief. Three, a second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. The Senate must and will do all three.
For his part, the Republican leader, Senator Mitch McConnell, had pushed for delaying the impeachment trial until February. He said it would give the Senate more time to give Trump due process.
That timeline would have provided the Senate some more floor time before we step up fully into the unknown of a trial, which, by the way, would have been a substantial benefit to the incoming administration and allowed them to get more of their cabinet confirmed.
The nomination is confirmed.
On the Biden cabinet confirmation front, today retired Army General Lloyd Austin became the first Black Secretary of Defense. The Senate voted to confirm him 93-2. Thursday, Congress agreed to exempt Austin from a rule banning recently retired military officers from heading the department. And the Senate will vote on the confirmation of Janet Yellen to be Treasury Secretary. She would be the first woman to hold that job.
And Yamiche joins me now. So, Yamiche, so much going on. Give us, though, a little more insight into these executive actions President Biden is taking to address the economic crisis.
Well, President Biden today really wanted to focus on the economic toll of the COVID-19 pandemic, talking specifically about Americans who have gone hungry, Americans who have lost their jobs, Americans who have been evicted from their homes. He said that America needed to do better and that these Americans needed the help of the federal government. There are also a number of Biden officials today who told me that there needs to be decisive action right now. Now, in particular, when we look at these executive orders, what they do is increase the assistance to low-income families, nutritional assistance. And when we look at that executive order, I want to, in some ways, talk to people about what are the facts that when it comes to food insecurity in this country. So as a result, 29 million Americans face a hunger crisis in this country. 12 million children often don't have enough to eat. 1 in 5 Black and Latino households struggle to secure food when they need it. Now, the White House says that this is really just a down payment, these executive orders, and that they need to pass, the Congress, that is, needs to pass that $1.9 trillion COVID relief package that Joe Biden is getting some pushback from, especially from moderates and some Republicans.
And Yamiche, just backing up, looking at this overall, here we are at the end of the president's first few days in office. He's only has a few cabinet members in place. What do we know now about his priorities?
Well, at the end of his first week as president, Joe Biden, it's clear, has a lot to juggle, and that the top priority for him remains COVID-19. It is true that he only has a few cabinet officials confirmed right now. He has two. That's Avril Haines, the director of National Intelligence, as well as General Lloyd Austin, his defense secretary, who is the first Black man to hold that position. Now, there is Tim Kaine, just a few minutes ago, said that he expects Antony Blinken, that's the treasurer, that's the Secretary of State nominee, to also be confirmed today. He also says that Alejandro Mayorkas may be confirmed as early as tomorrow. That would be the Secretary of Homeland Security. The other thing to note here is that there are a lot of topics on Joe Biden's agenda. And you can see that even though, of course, COVID-19 is his priority, he talked about immigration this week. He put forth plans on that. He also put forth plans on, again, economic relief, racial justice, criminal justice. The other thing to note is that all of this is happening, Joe Biden pushing his agenda, pushing his plans, as that impeachment trial is looming. And the Biden administration doesn't want to talk about how they think President Trump, the former president, should be held accountable for his role in the January 6th Capitol attack. Instead, they're saying that leave that up to the Congress. But they are doing something interesting, which is that they are overhauling, for the most part, the way that this country deals with domestic terrorism. Today, as we laid out in the story, they're really going to be asking federal agencies and intelligence agencies to look very deeply at radicalization in this country, white supremacy in this country. So that tells you where all of the things that they're juggling is heading at this point.
A lot on the plate, no question about it. Yamiche Alcindor reporting on the White House. Thank you, Yamiche. And now we turn our attention to Capitol Hill and to our Dan Bush, who is tracking the action there. So, Dan, some late developments late this afternoon, early this evening on the timing for that impeachment trial.
That's right, Judy. So much is fluid right now, and it's been changing by the hour. But the NewsHour just learned that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell are nearing a deal to begin the trial the week of February 8th. Schumer is about to speak in a little while, momentarily even, on the Senate floor to provide more details. There's still a lot we don't know. How long will it last? Whether there'll be witnesses or not, those details are being ironed out. Democrats do want a couple of things. We know that. They'd like to split up the days, that is, to conduct other Senate business, confirm President Biden's nominees, take up COVID relief while they conduct the Senate trial. Republicans have pushed back on that. We'll see where the deal ends up on that. One thing, though, Judy, in the last couple of days, I can say that support for conviction of President Trump, former President Trump, among Republicans has been going down. Several Republicans have been telling me that they just think that impeaching a former president is unconstitutional. So there's a lot of division both about the trial when it starts, but even, how it will get underway. And we should see more details on that in the next couple of hours.
So you have that impeachment trial pending, Dan. You also have this very busy agenda on the part of the new president. What are the folks in Congress telling you about their ability to do all of this at the same time? How confident are they can get it all done?
Well, right now, Judy, all eyes are on the Senate, and that's because McConnell and Schumer have yet to come up with an agreement for the rules for the new Senate, how to do this power-sharing agreement and a 50-50 split. Because of that, essentially right now, most work is on hold, except for some confirmations. Right now, even Republicans are technically still chairing committees, even though Democrats are now in charge of the Senate. They have to work out how this is all going to function. And the main sticking point is the legislative filibuster. McConnell has requested that Democrats ensure they don't do away with it. Chuck Schumer said on the floor earlier today that that is unacceptable and he won't accept it. Democrats want to make sure that essentially they keep that option on the table. This is a difficult moment for Democrats. Mitch McConnell is essentially saying, accede to some of our requests. Joe Biden in his inaugural address said to have some unity. We will see if that happens.
No question. It's all about how they work out the majority, whether it's 51 or 60. Big question to be resolved. Dan Bush, thanks so much. In the day's other news, President Biden has invoked the Defense Production Act to ramp up the nation's supply of COVID-19 vaccines amid shortages. That comes as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention quietly changed its vaccination guidance to allow patients to mix vaccine brands for their first and second doses in, quote, exceptional situations. Meanwhile, in Geneva, Switzerland, the World Health Organization hailed a new deal with Pfizer to supply up to 40 million doses to help inoculate people who live in poor countries.
Vaccines are giving us all hope of ending the pandemic and getting the global economy on the road to recovery. But we can only end the pandemic anywhere if we end it everywhere. And to do that, we need every member state, every partner, and every vaccine producer on board.
Pfizer said the vaccines would be provided at an undisclosed, not-for-profit price. There's word that nearly 200 National Guard members sent to Washington in the days leading up to the inauguration have tested positive for COVID-19. Officials fear they were exposed from working and taking rest breaks in close proximity with one another. About 26,000 troops were deployed to protect the U.S. Capitol after the insurrection on January 6th. That comes amid outrage over news reports that U.S. Capitol Police ordered the National Guard to leave the Capitol building yesterday. They were temporarily relocated to rest in a nearby parking garage while Congress was in session, but have since returned to the Capitol. Today, the acting Capitol Police Chief denied that they instructed the Guard troops to vacate the Capitol. Lawmakers demanded an investigation. Meanwhile, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden made an unscheduled stop near the Capitol to deliver cookies and thank a group of guardsmen for protecting her family. Russia today welcomed President Biden's proposal to extend the two countries' last remaining limit on their nuclear arsenals. The so-called New START Treaty is set to expire February 5th. It would remain in place for five more years once the renewal is formalized. Meanwhile, the first ever international treaty to ban nuclear weapons went into effect today. The United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was ratified by 61 countries who vowed to never develop or acquire such weapons. But it is largely symbolic, since neither the United States nor any of the world's other nuclear-armed nations have signed on. Back in this country, the National Association of Realtors reported that home sales in 2020 soared to their highest level in 14 years. It's largely due to a surge in existing home sales in December. Overall, yearly sales rose nearly 6.5 million. Record low mortgage rates and remote work during the pandemic helped to drive up demand. Meanwhile, stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 179 points to close at 30,997. The Nasdaq rose 12 points and the S&P 500 slipped 11. And Henry Aaron, one of baseball's greatest all-around players,
has died. The Hall of Famer spent most of his career with the Braves in Milwaukee and then Atlanta and held the home run record for 33 years. He was also a passionate civil rights advocate after enduring rampant racism through much of his career. Hank Aaron was 86 years old, and we'll have much more on his life later in the program.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
One of the consequences of the chaos from the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, a distancing from banks and other businesses from former President Trump. Paul Solman for our Making Sense series looks at the economic hit facing Mr. Trump.
I'm the king of debt. I'm great with debt. Nobody knows debt better than me. I've made a fortune by using debt.
In the early 1990s, Donald Trump also lost a fortune using debt. He could face similar problems today.
Most of his money is tied up in real estate, and real estate that's been hard hit by COVID-19. He has debts north of $1 billion, and a big chunk of that debt is coming due soon.
Journalist Tim O'Brien has covered Trump for decades, wrote Trump Nation with Trump's cooperation, published in 2005.
He really runs the risk of being cash strapped at a time when his banks and other businesses are turning their backs on him because of the January 6th insurrection.
Famous hotels, famous golf courses, a $2 billion plus empire by most estimates. But 60% of Trump's wealth is held in just five buildings in San Francisco and New York, says O'Brien.
The four buildings in New York are Trump Tower, a retail space next to Trump Tower that used to be known as Nike Town, but Nike moved out.
Then there's 1290 6th Avenue, and he owns what once vied for tallest skyscraper in the world, 40 Wall Street, filled with offices.
He's very dependent on all of those spaces in that building being occupied, and occupancy rates are at rock bottom levels.
At the moment, the real estate, the collateral on his debt, just isn't worth what it used to be. And if it were worth less than he owes on it,
it would be the same thing as a homeowner who has too much mortgage on their home, and they have to sell the home for less than they paid for it. With him, he's got a whole basket full of properties that are stressed like that.
So the possibility is, to use the homeowner analogy, that he gets foreclosed on?
That could happen. It really depends on the timing of when each loan comes due, how strict the debt holders are about making him pay. It's whether or not he can find other properties he could sell quickly.
Or find new lenders. But, says Nancy Wallace,
Donald Trump has burned a lot of bridges in commercial lending.
Professor Wallace chairs the real estate group at Berkeley's Business School.
Given his casino failures, most large commercial lenders wouldn't work with him because of his behavior in those bankruptcies.
Even his go-to lender for decades, Deutsche Bank, has now severed ties, as have three other banks, including Signature, on whose board his daughter Ivanka once sat.
Basically, they closed his accounts. I mean, forget about borrowing. They don't even want his bank accounts.
You mean a bank said, here's your money, we don't even want your deposits?
That's correct.
Because they're afraid of what?
There is huge reputational risk in banking. And anything that's associated with significant lack of transparency is too risky. And we haven't even spoken about the Scottish assets.
Yes, the Scottish assets. Several prominent golf courses and hotels. No outside loans on those properties, says reporter Martin McLaughlin in Glasgow. But
it's not a single one of Trump's companies here has ever turned a profit. They have yet to pay a penny in corporation tax. Cumulatively, they have incurred losses of approximately £55 million. I've looked through some of the business that the hotels are doing. In some cases, it's single-figure weddings over the course of a year.
And thus, the question now being asked by authorities in Scotland. Where did the money come from?
And there's obviously been a lot of speculation that the money is coming from somewhere like Russia, like Azerbaijan and Georgia, suspected foreign individuals who may or may be involved or have family who are involved in money laundering.
And if they determined money laundering was involved, could they take his properties?
If the owner of the property can't disclose the financing, there is a mechanism for those properties to be seized.
Purely hypothetical. But if his properties were seized, he'd obviously have fewer assets with which to raise cash. And even if he holds on to everything, says Tim O'Brien.
It's private equity investors, hedge funds, anyone who wants to get into distressed real estate. They just want to wait until he has to sell the property so they can get it cheaply.
So you're suggesting that the private equity community or private capital in general basically is smelling blood in the water?
They all can smell when someone else is hurting, and they're more than willing to watch that person bleed out until they can get something as cheaply as they possibly can.
But he was just able to raise like a couple of $100 million from people who back him. I mean, doesn't he have a tremendous source of financing there?
He can try to use those funds for non-political purposes, but it's illegal.
There's a final financial specter haunting Trump. His taxes, says Wallace.
And given what looks to be a lot of shenanigans in terms of how he declares assets for tax purposes and how he declares assets for borrowing purposes, there could be a serious problem there.
And the issue there is he declares a building worth a great deal of money so that he can borrow a lot against it, and then when he files his taxes, he claims that the building is worth a lot less?
Yes, for the underpayment of taxes.
Possibly a crime, but even if not,
he might have a huge tax bill to the tune of $100 million.
All this had me deeply skeptical of Trump's financial future and left me with one last question, which I put to Dan Alexander, author of White House, Inc. Why can't he just declare bankruptcy?
Well, the thing is that Trump, his overall portfolio is actually solvent. He's got really valuable assets. He does have some cash that he could use. So he can pay back these loans. The question really is whether he wants to.
We asked the Trump Organization for comment and have not gotten a response. But yesterday, Donald Trump's son Eric told the New York Times that the Trump Organization remains stable with steady cash flow and relatively low debt. Still, according to the company's own filings, the Trump Organization revenues declined more than 35% last year, says Dan Alexander.
But you're either going to see new lenders or you're going to look at a Trump Organization and Trump empire that looks much smaller come about 2024 than it does in 2021. And the irony of all of this is that if he had just done what everyone told him to do at the start, which was liquefy everything, take all that money and stick it into the S&P 500, he would be hundreds of millions of dollars richer today.
Because the stock market is up nearly 80% since Donald Trump took office. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Salmon.
The confirmation of Lloyd Austin as the first black U.S. Secretary of Defense is a milestone. Nick Schifrin reports on how it also spotlights racial disparities at the highest level of the military ranks.
Hello, everybody.
When Lloyd Austin arrived at the Pentagon today, he broke through what's been called the brass ceiling. In a 40-year career, he was the first black officer to command a division in combat, the first black officer to command an entire theater of war, and now the first black Secretary of Defense.
To hit every single one of those gates is incredible. So to me, that is much like hitting the lottery.
Irving Smith is a retired Army colonel and former West Point professor. He says the military provides opportunity for black enlisted troops to rise to positions like sergeant, but to rise through the officer ranks, like four-star General Austin did, the barriers are systemic. He read a 1995 U.S. Army War College research project, Why Black Officers Fail, and in 2010, he wrote a follow-up, Why Black Officers Still Fail.
There's this thing called the Good Old Boy Network. There's a system in the Army that is it's like nepotism that exists there. And as long as that persists, black officers will have a very hard time making it to the senior ranks.
In 1994, black soldiers were 27% of the Army, but only 11% of the officers. 2007, black soldiers were 20% of the Army, but only 12% of the officers. Today, the problem persists. The Pentagon provided PBS NewsHour data we analyzed for the entire military. Black service members are 16% of the military, but only 8% of its officers. White service members are 55% of the military, but 72% of the officers. A major problem, the lack of black mentorship.
Most of the African-American officers were coming out of historically black colleges, and those historically black colleges weren't providing the mentorship up front, whereas the West Point cadets were getting the very best officers to teach them from day one. And so they weren't necessarily being given the right guidance on the right assignments to take.
That's a reference to the military's combat units, where black service members are 11% of the enlisted, but only 5% of the officers. White combat service members are 64% of the enlisted and 78% of the officers. In fact, in combat units, as the percentage of white officers rises with seniority, the percentage of black officers drops from 8% of second lieutenants down to 4% for colonels. In combat support units such as logistics, the disparity remains, but the numbers get better. Black service members are 20% of the enlisted and 10% of the officers. Smith says that's indicative of black soldiers self-selecting.
I came into the Army because I was going to do 5 years, get out, and make a lot of money, right? I fell in love with the Army when I was in the Army, and I found my calling when I was there. But my parents were like, why did you go into the infantry? That was the dumbest thing you could do. Why didn't you go in the Signal Corps where you could learn to work satellites and get a job at, you know, some big satellite company afterwards?
Smith says young black soldiers who choose support roles like Signal Corps limits the number of black officers who become generals.
It's well known that the combat units, those combat arms professions, produce the senior leaders of the future.
There is no justifiable reason for discrimination.
The military is proud of its past efforts to fight racism. Thanks to a President Truman executive order, the military was one of the first American institutions to integrate. Black men have risen to its most senior ranks. Colin Powell, the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And just last summer, Air Force General C.Q. Brown, the first black service chief. But before he was confirmed, he posted a video about the racism that he experienced.
I'm thinking about the pressure I felt to perform error-free, especially for supervisors I perceive had expected less from me as an African-American.
We can't just lay this on a black leader to say, go fix this. The Caucasian leaders of the services, you know, have to fix this issue, have to really go after it.
Admiral Mike Mullen was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2007 to 2011. Today, he voiced rare criticism of his successors.
Do you believe that the current leadership across the military has taken this as a priority?
The current leadership of the military has not taken it as a priority. And I think the evidence is just in the numbers. Look at the lack of senior four stars in particular who are black or Hispanic.
Mullen hired Austin to be the joint staff director. One day, Austin told his boss, come downstairs to take a photo. Never before had so many senior black officers helped lead the joint staff.
And I said, what's all this about? And one of them said, this is history. And every one of them was doing an exceptional job for me.
To increase the percentage of black officers, Mullen says that old boys network has to change from the lowest ranks.
I've had this theory forever on these promotion boards. There's a phrase I use, you know, ducks pick ducks. And these boards are dominated by Caucasian senior officers, typically. It's hard to break that. And this is a long-term issue where you have to enlarge the pool there in order to expect to be able to promote people to admiral and generals.
Smith says commanders should be judged by the diversity of their staff and the climates they create, and that ROTC programs must be improved. He's confident that Secretary Austin can do that.
This is a great occasion, not for Black America, but for America.
If the saying is, I cannot be what I cannot see, today every young service member can see him. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
And now we turn to the first Friday analysis of the Biden administration with Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. So good to see both of you. We got to spend Wednesday together virtually, but there's nothing like Friday night. It's great to have you both. Jonathan, I'm going to start with you. We've had a couple of days to absorb what inauguration was. What stays with you? What lingers?
Judy, the thing that stays with me is the mood and the tone set by President Biden. And we talked about this on Wednesday, how the poem by Amanda Gorman and the national anthem sung by Lady Gaga and her turning to the flag and singing the flag was still there, just how stirring that was. But in the days since, the thing that I keep coming back to is that I felt like I was welcome in this country again. I had a feeling of welcome home, and that we were being led by a person of empathy, of decency, of moral character, but also one who sees the country as it is and wants to lead all of us, not just the 80 million people who voted him into office.
Goes pretty deep. David, what about you? What stays with you?
Weirdly, a phrase that didn't seem too remarkable at the time, but I think sums up Joe Biden pretty well. He said, you know, there's this thing about life is that sometimes you need a hand, and sometimes you're called upon to lend a hand. And that's, of course, true about life, but it's also true about the kind of family Joe Biden grew up in and the sort of town he grew up in and the sort of America he envisions, which is an independent America, interdependent America, where we help each other out and we help each other rise and succeed. It's a vision of America. And so when he calls for unity, it's not like come by, let's all come together. It's an argument for a certain kind of America where people can rise and succeed with each other's help. And we've lived for 4 years with, and more, longer, with widening and very wide cleavages between left and right, between white and black, between rich and poor. The country has just had these ravines open up or stay open that are ancient. And now you at least get the image somebody's working on the problem to bridge the ravines. And I do think that's why it's unity for something, not just for the sake of being united.
And Jonathan, he's followed up what he said on Wednesday with a flurry of these executive orders and statements. Does it feel like, I mean, what is the sense you're getting from this in terms of his priorities, what message he's trying to send to the American people? And are these things that can make permanent change, even though they're executive orders?
Well, the message that he's been sending since that picture was taken is that there's confidence back in the Oval Office, there's action back in the Oval Office, and that he meant what he said on the campaign trail about what he was going to do as president, and certainly what he was going to do as president on day one. A lot of those executive actions and executive orders are about reversing some of the more egregious things that President Trump did, from the Muslim ban to pulling the United States out of the WHO. His priorities, President Biden's priorities, have been, first and foremost, COVID, getting a handle on the pandemic. And the first executive order he signed had to do with the coronavirus pandemic. But then let's not forget that he submitted a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. So that's not executive action, that's legislation. And if that gets passed by Congress, that is law, and relief will come to the American people. But I think with the executive actions, and apparently there's going to be 10 days of this, he's trying to show that the absence of leadership that we have seen, certainly since Election Day from the previous administration, has been completely reversed, in that he is focused like a laser beam on helping the country and helping the American people.
What's coming through to you, David? And I mean, and what's to keep this from just being the ping pong? Donald Trump reverses what Barack Obama did, Joe Biden reverses what Donald Trump did.
Nothing's done to, they could be ping pong. Lyndon Johnson used to say that executive orders are just paper. You can sign them, and then 4 years later, somebody can unsign them. And that's why Johnson emphasized laws. You got to pass laws. But I have to say, when I think of these EOs, they're strong, but they're not overly ambitious. Jonathan and I were on a couple calls during the transition with President Biden, and he said, I do not believe in the imperial presidency. He's a man whose life was formed in the Senate. He believes in Congress. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at these, they take actions, but they don't take actions in a way that would alarm somebody who thinks he's taking power he doesn't actually have. Reversing Trump policies that were reversing Trump executive orders, he clearly has the right to do that. The others, they seem pretty modest. Making sure there's mask wearing within federal property, that's reasonably limited. Raising the food stamp benefits, that's a good policy, but quite limited. So I think he's threading needles here, doing stuff, but not overreaching in a way that would alarm either members of his own party, but especially members of the other party.
And what about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you get the sense that because you're hearing some welcoming comments, but you're also hearing some pushback from Republicans. Do you get the sense that he's going to find cooperation or a closed door?
I think that President Biden has been operating under the hope that his calls for unity and let's work together and let's make Washington work for the American people, that there will be some people on the other side of the aisle who will join with him in getting legislation over the finish line. On one of those calls that David and I were on with then President-elect Biden, I asked the question, look, Mr. President-elect, yes, you want to work with Republicans, but what do you say to Democrats who believe that you are naive and don't see the sucker punch that's coming from Republicans? And I quoted Mike Tyson to him saying, you know, Mike Tyson once famously said, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the mouth. And so are you ready for the punch in the mouth that's coming? And he said, basically, you guys think I don't know what I'm doing. I've been around the block for a long time. I am not afraid of a fight. And so I think what President Biden is doing is rhetorically, but also through actions, showing that he wants people to come in. But time will tell, at what point does President Biden decide, okay, enough of trying to work with these folks, now I'm gonna lower the hammer, and now I'm gonna show them that I know how to fight. And I suggest to anyone, or I would say to anyone who doubts that President Biden has the will and the stomach for a fight, that they need to make a reassessment, because I actually believe that he is willing to fight.
Well, he certainly, David, has the recent example of President Obama and what happened when he tried to work with the Congress. I mean, what do you think he faces?
Yeah, I thought Jonathan's question really got the hair on the back of his neck going straight up, because he was angry, not at Jonathan, just angry.
He
was feisty. And I would say, it's worth giving it a shot. The Republican Party is very divided. I know many Republicans in the Senate who would like to work with him, and they think there are issues upon which they can work for him. There's this Problem Solvers Caucus and then a Common Sense Caucus, this bipartisan group that did the COVID relief bill. They want to end partisan gridlock. And so I may be naive, but I'm a little more hopeful. And I would remind everyone, Republicans voted for $3 trillion in new federal spending over the last 11 months. That's a lot of spending they voted for. And the problem is not over. I think there is some possibility. Having said that, there's a big debate now on whether the Democrats should end the filibuster. And I've spent my entire professional life supporting the filibuster because I think it forces parties to try to at least work a little across the aisle. Nonetheless, in this crisis, in this situation, I just don't think we can afford 2 years of government paralysis. So if Republicans do go into full oppo mode, I do think Democrats should end the filibuster. That'll be tough because West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has sworn that he will never vote for it, and there may be other Democrats. But we just can't have paralysis for two more years. And taking down a Senate institution, which I believe in principle, seems to be the necessary thing.
Wow. Well, we'll see in the coming days what happens with that. But we've got, a little over a minute or so left. But I want each of you to ask each of you about this impeachment trial. It looks like maybe February the 9th. What do you expect from that, Jonathan?
Judy, I expect the trial to be brief, meaning not 20-something days. I wouldn't be surprised if that Friday after the trial starts, which I believe it might be the 8th or the 9th of February, that we could be talking about a potential verdict. We're talking about one article of impeachment, and we all witnessed what they're going to be talking about with our own eyes. So I don't expect the trial itself to last very long.
And David, you want to go on the record? Would you expect conviction or not?
No, I do not. I'd like to know if it's even constitutional. The Constitution really says it's the impeachment's about removal from office. It's not clear to me that they have the ability to remove somebody who's already been removed by voters. But if it does happen, I hope it's short. Presidents only get one 100-day period, and they've got to use every day of that 100-day period. And so I hope it does not become a distraction.
February, big month coming up, just like January, but hopefully different, certainly, in a lot of respects. Thank you both, David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart.
Thanks, Judy.
So good to see you both.
You too.
As we've reported, one of America's greatest athletes, Henry Aaron, died today at the age of 86. I was privileged to know him a little. A few years ago, he and his wife, Billy, accepted my invitation to a press dinner here in Washington, where they were mobbed by admirers, and he received the longest standing ovation I think I've ever heard. He couldn't have been more gracious. It was typical of this man who, as Jeffrey Brown reports, endured blatant racism through much of his life.
And another standing ovation, number five.
Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, April 8, 1974. Henry Hank Aaron steps into the batter's box, one home run away from passing Babe Ruth for the all-time record.
Hit more to right and right center than the left. There's a long drive. Balls it deep, deep. It is gone.
The moment, a capstone to a career that had already cemented Hank Aaron as one of baseball's best ever.
I felt great. I felt like I had the world was lifted off of my shoulders.
A great moment in all of sports history, but also one tinged with the bitterness of American history, as racism chased Aaron as he chased the record that would hold up for 33 years.
I got threatening letters about kidnapping and things like this, vicious, racist letters. I had to slip out of the back of the ballpark with escorts and things like this. It was terrible, terrible. It was bad times for me.
His perseverance and grace throughout would gain him widespread admiration, and he became a trailblazer and inspiration for black athletes who followed. Aaron was born in Jim Crow-era Mobile, Alabama, during the Great Depression. He played his early baseball in the segregated Negro Leagues, and at 20 years old joined the Milwaukee Braves. He followed the team to Atlanta, and in 21 years with the franchise, Hammer and Hank became one of the game's most fearsome hitters. In all, Aaron slugged 755 home runs and amassed 3,000 hits. He was an All-Star for 21 straight seasons and won an MVP award and a World Series title. In 1982, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Today, tributes to Aaron poured in. Former President Barack Obama called him one of the strongest people I've ever met. We reached Dave Roberts, manager of the world champion Los Angeles Dodgers, by phone. He had this to say.
For me, even more so as a man of color, just to kind of think about how he handled the adversities and the personal hate towards him as he approached that home run record. And he always handled it with grace, dignity. And there was never any resentfulness when he was talking to current players or peers of his.
Hank Aaron died today at 86 years old.
And joining me now is Howard Bryant. He's a sports writer and author of The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. Thanks for joining us again. Let's start with the player first. I mean, we always talk about the home runs, but he was one of the all-time greats in every way, right?
No question. Let me just give you one example of how good Henry Aaron is or was as a player. When he came into the big leagues in 1954, his goal, his mission as a young player was to break Stan Musial's all-time National League hits record of 3,630. By the time his career started to move forward, he began realizing that the team, the Atlanta Braves or the Milwaukee Braves at the time, needed more offense. And so he decided to hit more home runs. And so one day I said to him, were you so good that you were able to choose which all-time record you wanted to break? And he sort of laughed about it, but it really is true that he had so much ability as a hitter that he started his career trying to break one all-time unreachable record and then ended up breaking another one.
It is, though, impossible to talk about the achievement without looking at all the evil that he went through. I was reading about a 20th anniversary after he broke the home run record when he told a reporter, "It really led to turning me off of baseball, all that he went through. It really made me see a clear picture of what the country is about." Talk a little bit about that, what he did experience.
What he experienced is the American story. He experienced what America tells you to do, which is to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It tells you to work hard and not complain. It tells you to give the best of your ability. And Henry did all of those things. And when he got to the top, what did he receive? He received people trying to kill him, which undermined everything about this meritocracy that we've been told them to believe in. And when you have an FBI detail and you have kidnapping threats to your family just because you're swinging a baseball bat, it makes you look at things a very different way. He always told me, this was supposed to be the happiest moment of my life, and it never turned out to be that way. And that's really telling. It's a real indictment. I think people recognized over time that America caught up to Henry, but he was far, far ahead of it back in 1974.
And yet he persevered. He went on to a career afterwards. What was he like as a person that allowed him to do what he did even after his career?
Well, I think he had an enormous amount of confidence in himself, an enormous amount of pride. He understood that his ability was affording him a life that was never going to be available to so many other African Americans. And he felt he had a responsibility to use that talent. One of my favorite stories with Henry was, I remember being in his house and we were talking and he was telling me about how he did not want to move to Atlanta when the Milwaukee Braves moved to Atlanta after the 1965 season, because he knew what racism was down there. He knew what Jim Crow was all about. And he ended up having a meeting with Ralph Abernathy and Andrew Young and Martin Luther King Jr. And they told him, when he said, I don't think I'm doing my part for this movement. I'm just a player. And Dr. King told him, you are as important to this movement as we are. You do the things that you do. We need you as much as the rest of the country needs us. And I remember him telling me that he couldn't imagine what life would have been like had he not gone to Atlanta. That put him right in the center of the civil rights movement, and it centered him as a person.
I wonder what he was thinking of where the game is now. I mean, he talked a lot about lamenting that more blacks weren't going into baseball, the openings for managers still were fairly limited. Where are we now? What do you think he thought?
He felt all of those things. You're absolutely right. But I know he was far more concerned about where the country was at. I talked to him 3 weeks ago to wish him a happy new year. One of the things he wanted to talk about was, one, surviving the Trump era. And then also the fact how proud he was of Georgia, that his state, and he and his wife, Billy, very, very deep into Democratic politics there, that they saw some history and that they were in the center of change. I am personally happy that he got to see this thing through.
He saw history. He made history. The life and legacy of Henry Hank Aaron. Howard Bryant, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As we pass the grim milestone this week of more than 400,000 Americans who've died from COVID-19, we take this moment to remember another 5 of the extraordinary lives lost.
James Glica Hernandez was drawn to the stage and became a fixture on the regional theater scene in California's Central Valley. As musical director of the Woodland Opera House for over two decades, he mentored generations of young performers. Friends described him as bold and unapologetic, and someone who inspired people to live authentically. A self-described family man, James was a loving husband, father, and grandfather. He was 61. Maude Jones was known for her soft voice and positive attitude. Her daughter said the 64-year-old loved working as a teacher's aide for elementary school students with disabilities in Gwinnett County, Georgia. Maude was born in Liberia and moved to the U.S. in her 20s, but always maintained close ties to her homeland and culture. Faith also played a big part in Maude's life. Her family said she never missed her church's Sunday service or Wednesday Bible study. Richard Means spent his life fighting for free and fair elections in his home state of Illinois. Born in Champaign, Richard settled in Chicago and represented local, state, and national candidates from all parties as a top election lawyer. He was irreverent and fearless, his wife said, and he advocated for many progressive causes outside of the courtroom. Richard loved his grandchildren, cooking, and architecture. He was 78. If you were friends with Virginia Roberts, you were friends for life, her daughter said. The New Jersey native loved her community of Lake Parsippany, where she lived in the same cottage for 55 years and raised four children. She also rescued and cared for many animals. Virginia worked most of her life, retiring just 3 years ago from her job as a school bus aide. She was 84. Louis Ayala loved cutting hair. It was his job for 75 years. He started young as a teenager, working at a neighborhood barbershop in Fort Worth, Texas. He went on to own his own shop on the city's main street. His nephew said he was a quiet and stoic man who would make house visits if customers couldn't leave their homes. An avid golfer, Lewis advocated for the redevelopment of an inner city golf course, a dream that came true in 2017. Lewis was 90 years old. And our thanks to all the family members who shared these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. And a correction before we go. Yesterday, we mistakenly showed an image of damage from a volcanic eruption when we were discussing nuclear weapons. We regret the error. And don't forget to tune in to Washington Week tonight when NewsHour's Amna Nawaz leads a discussion of President Biden's first days and the Democrats' plans to impeach the former president. And before we go, it's hard to believe, but tomorrow marks 1 year since the death of one of our two beloved founding fathers, Jim Lehrer. Every day we think of him, and we do our best to live out his journalistic ethics. We send our love to his wife, Kate, to their daughters, Jamie, Lucy, and Amanda, and their families. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, have a good, safe weekend. Thank you, and good night.